KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1917, a flamboyant, energetic American doctor makes this claim, that he had found a way to cure impotence with goat testicle transplants. And not only that, the guy really sold it, said they cured insanity and heart disease and epilepsy. Come on, right? Well, Penny Lane's documentary is kind of doing the same thing as The Good Doctor, a man named John Romulus Brinkley. She's spinning a tale, using the structure of her film to try and sell us something. In this case, she's trying to explain how a quack works. Lane is joining us today to talk about her film premiering at Sundance this year, and there's a lot going on in here. Animation and radio and junk mail, and then, of course, there's the goat balls part. The film is called Nuts. Join us after the news. This week on Video West, we've got a new installment in our street portrait series. We went up to Park City to do some people watching on Main Street during the Sundance Film Festival. It's kind of a wintry fashion runway up there. Lots of furry boots and puffy jackets and sleek denim. A lot of really well-dressed people. And we talked with some of them about their own approaches to fashion, which really end up being approaches to life. So check it out in the street portrait section at videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you see Penny Lane's new documentary, Nuts, about John Romulus Brinkley, you're going to want to believe him. You'll have your suspicions right away. I mean, he does claim he can cure impotence through his surgical procedure where he transplants goat testicles into men. And by the way, it's not just impotence that these goat glands procedures take care of. They give you more energy and take care of your constipation and epilepsy and insanity. It cures insanity. Oh, and he's also developed a cancer-fighting toothpaste and vision-improving cream. And of course, it sounds fishy, but Brinkley was a lovable guy. He went to church picnics and he made donations to charity. And his personal story is really compelling. He succeeded against powerful odds and powerful opposition. He was this populist fighting against the establishment. Penny Lane's documentary helps us understand why it is we want to believe someone like John Brinkley. It's called Nuts, as I said, and Penny Lane is joining us today to talk about it. It's part of the Sundance U.S. documentary competition. It's Penny Lane's second documentary feature film. You might remember back in 2014, she joined us to talk about her film, Our Nixon. And Penny Lane, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me back.
I should mention there's a wait list for tomorrow's final screening of the film. So you never know.
You can try. Yeah.
You give it a shot. Why not? We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Okay, so tell me how you found the story of John Romulus Brinkley. Where did you find it first?
Like all good things,
yeah.
In a public library.
Right.
So I was in a library and there was, you know, there's a section for like librarian picks, like new nonfiction librarian picks. And there was a book called Charlatan and it had a big picture of a goat on the cover and it said like, flim flam and like other old-timey words. And I said, that looks interesting. And I took it home and read it and just devoured this book and immediately knew. I mean, it just was shocked that no one had made a film about this guy before because it seemed to me that his story was so made for the movies. It's very dramatic. You know, as you said, it's this kind of tragic tale. It's a very classic kind of up from the bootstraps sort of thing, but like starring a sociopath, you know, with all this humor kind of embedded along the way. And I was so taken with it. But the thing that made me want to make the movie, and the movie took almost 8 years to make. Yeah. So, you know, you have to have something that's driving you beyond like, what a cool story.
Right.
At least for me, I did. And the thing that really kept me engaged was exactly what you were talking about in your intro, which was as I was reading this book, I was turning the pages very quickly because it was very entertaining. And there was something about it that I wanted to believe in it. And I'm a very skeptical person. I don't like believing ghosts, you know, and I'm like that jerk who's always like, yeah, homeopathy is just sugar pills.
Right.
You know, so I'm not someone who I think of as being particularly susceptible to something like as insane as his goat gland cure. But I still just kind of wanted to believe in it. And and that really struck me. And as I was telling people about the film, when I started developing it, I noticed that everybody wanted to believe. So I'd say, oh, I'm working on this film about this guy who did this thing. And the first question would be, well, did it work? And I'd be like, no, of course it didn't work. But then they'd look sad.
Yeah.
And so I thought that would be the thing I would want to explore. Like exactly what you asked. Like what is it about this person that made him make us want to believe him? And it's quite universal. It's a playbook used by every charlatan,
yep, totally.
Every con man.
Which we'll break down because I want to spend some time with
totally.
Those because every trope, every little moment in the textbook, he kind of uses at some point or another throughout his life, and it's really interesting. I think one of the most remarkable things, though, about the film is how you make the audience part of it, right? That, and this is how you've put it before. You said you wanted us, the audience, to feel seduced
yeah.
and fooled.
Yeah, that was really important to me because what a boring movie it would be to say, like, you know, in the first 30 seconds, here's this silly scam and look at all these dummies who fell for it. That just wasn't appealing to me. So the alternative for me was to put you in the position in one way or another. You know, different people come to it with different levels of skepticism or openness yeah. or, you know, maybe they even know who Brinkley is already.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely wanted you to feel the power of that seductive force that is the great storyteller that was John Brinkley. Because that's what I came to believe, was that the most important element to his con, really, and all cons, is a story. Mm-hmm. A story that you want to believe, a story that's too good to be true, a story that makes you like the world more than you know did
yeah.
before.
Yeah. Even though that goes against all of your ideas about what's actually irrational and possible, you're kind of rooting for...
Well, it's like wanting to believe in ghosts.
Totally.
Because
yeah.
it's cooler.
That's right.
Or mermaids.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I want the world to be more yeah. awesome too, you know?
Yeah. The structure of the film, let's say something a little bit about that. Because you've talked about it being sort of this... It's in, I don't know if it's acts or chapters. It has pieces to it. And you've described it as kind of a classical tragedy. Would you say something about the structure? Because I think that's interesting.
For sure. I mean, I think that when you read the log line, you would think it was a comedy. And I actually thought about that a lot. And it's a funny movie. But like R. Nixon, it's a funny movie, but it's not a comedy, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have a happy ending. That's the most basic difference between a comedy and a tragedy.
Yep. It's a big one.
It's a big one. And it really does dictate a lot of other things about the story. The tragedy is that here's a guy who is born with nothing at all, like just the most abject poverty you could imagine at the turn of the 20th century. And really, truly, through his own hard work and genius and grit and determination, rises to these insane heights of celebrity and wealth, all of which you see in the film. But it's his own hubris that brings him down in the end. And this is
a fatal flaw.
This is what we talked about a couple years ago
totally.
With Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fatal flaw in Brinkley's case, I think, although it's a little hard to say, is that he started to believe his own lies. I think that's what happened because otherwise I can't explain why he did the things he did.
Well, he was getting away with it
exactly.
for so long. There's a crucial moment where things turn. We'll get to that. Let's let people hear his voice. It's such a great voice, and you can tell how he's a great storyteller. Now, as we'll talk about as we come along, we come to hear him because he had this radio show. He had this radio station.
Yeah.
Really, I have to say, great radio station, it seemed like, in many ways. But this is how we get to hear the voice of Dr. Brinkley. And in this moment here, he's just giving us a sense of one of the things, anyway, that's really appealing about him, and what you mentioned, Penny, before, was that, you know, he pulled himself up through his own efforts and his bootstraps. Here's a moment from Penny's documentary.
When I left my little cabin home in western North Carolina, I'd known very few of the comforts and conveniences of life. Tender ties bound me to those scenes of my early boyhood, and I loved every rail fence and smoky chimney and coon dog. But I wanted to do better. I had seen my father wear himself out struggling in those mountains, and I knew that it would be necessary for me to find a more promising field. I'd learned the story of Lincoln, who rose from obscurity to the highest peak of fame and found inspiration in his early struggles. Being ambitious, I wanted the best, and I was determined to acquire it. But I realized that the best was a choice prize to be won only by those with the grit to fight doggedly for it.
Yeah, I'm on his side already, right?
Yeah, right. Really pulling at the heartstrings there.
Totally. But by the way, is any of that true?
Yeah, in the sense that he was born very poor and became a doctor of sorts and knew that he had to work hard. Yeah, but he didn't go to medical school. He bought his degree. He was someone who could have gone to medical school and been a great doctor, but he had a different plan. He wanted to go a little faster than that.
Yeah.
Why spend 4 years in medical school when you can just do it right now?
Exactly. He has this story that he tells, which turns out to be bullcrap, but he is, you know, he's wearing a – and the image that we get, the animated image, is great because he's standing in front of this guy at Johns Hopkins and he's appealing to be a medical doctor.
Please, please let me be a doctor.
Please let me be a doctor, but I don't have any shoes on and I just have a crummy pair of trousers and a shirt on. And, of course, he's this elite fellow. And this seems to be the theme that he keeps pushing throughout his life.
Yeah.
Turns him down.
Yeah.
You're not worthy. It's a class thing. And he really works that.
Oh, he really works it. Yeah. I mean, again, it's very unlikely that that happened.
Yeah.
but it's a great story and it's a great origin story, right? Like,
yeah.
So my film starts – so my film tries to sort of like give you the story as he told it. But then also, you know, again, as you know, if you've seen it – and it's not really a spoiler to say this. But, you know, as the film goes on, you come to understand that the version of the story that he tells – is you have a lot of reasons to believe it's not true. So the story with him at Johns Hopkins is a key moment in his life. And that's important for him because for him to generate your sympathy, he needs to position himself as the little man fighting the powerful, you know, mechanisms of the government and the elite and the rich people. Even after he becomes one of the wealthiest people in America, he continues to sort of work this theme of him being the little man, you know, up against the powerful government. And I think that works really well because we love that story.
We do.
I love that story.
Yeah.
We love an underdog.
And people today, we won't spend a lot of time with the 2016 presidential election, but I have to say there are elements of a populist appealing to people and the establishment freaking out, it's the same thing.
And an outsider.
And an outsider.
Because we haven't mentioned yet that, yes, it's really hard to summarize this movie because he does so many different chapters in his life. But, yes, he runs for governor of Kansas.
We're going to get to that, by the way.
Oh, okay.
No, we're going to get to all those elements because that's the great part.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with the thing that – the procedure that gives us the title, Nuts. So the way the story plays out, and I'll play this element in the film, where you essentially recreate through animation. Let's talk about the animation part really first before we do that. So essentially, you have three different chapters, and they're animated differently. So it has a really interesting dynamic style to it. You want to say something about that?
Yeah. So the idea was it's actually seven chapters.
Seven chapters, sorry.
It's okay. And then there's a different artist who hand draws and animates each chapter. And the reason that we wanted to do it that way was that we wanted to subtly and then overtly kind of tell you without telling you that we're giving you different versions of the story. And when someone different draws Brinkley or draws a scene from his life that we've already seen but draws it a different way, you kind of are reminded that the story depends on the storyteller.
Yeah.
And so there's a very kind of shift over time where the way that you, for example, see John Brinkley as this heroic figure, you know, starts to change, but it's subtle because it's happening visually. That was kind of the idea.
Yeah. Okay, so set this scene up for us. So John Brinkley has moved to Milford, Kansas, this kind of one-horse town, and he sets up his practice as a doctor. A man comes in and tells him that he's impotent.
Flat tire.
Flat tire. I have to say, I love the terms for impotence. Like, I don't even know if I can use this term. Floppy dong is one too. That was one of my favorite moments in the film. But anyway, so he comes in and says he's impotent, and he's wondering if there's a cure. And John Brinkley, according to the story, says, you know, no, I'm afraid there's not really much we can do. And the man looks out the window, according to the story, and he sees an enthusiastic billy goat having sex. Good enough?
That seems like a good setup to me.
Okay, yeah. Good. Here we go.
I'm a flat tire.
Flat tire? What does that mean?
Well, for 16 years, I've been trying to have a child with my wife.
Well, I can't help you. Modern medical science has not yet solved the problems of sexual weakness and childless homes.
I see. That fella out there sure is something.
Something? Yes.
It's too bad I don't have Billy Goat Nuts.
Too bad.
Say, Doc, why don't you just put some in me?
Beg your pardon?
Put some goat nuts in me. You know, graft them on.
To cure your impotence, you want me to implant goat testicles into you.
Well, Doc, they can't be worse than the nuts I got.
Well, there'll be a small fee.
So, let's talk about, this crazy implausible thing, the idea of gland transplants from goats takes off. It becomes a thing.
Absolutely. And it wasn't that implausible at the time. Yeah. It's 100 years ago.
And impotence was a big issue.
Well, impotence had been, it had probably always been a big issue. But, you know, again, like we had just sort of, science had just sort of started to become aware of what hormones were and how these glands in our body worked. And it was a big deal. It was sort of like what you would read about if you were reading about the new scientific advances. So like all quacks, Brinkley took something that was real, exciting, hot, cutting edge in science, but little understood.
Yeah.
And, you know, stole the idea and sold it. A real scientist does studies, publishes their results,
shares
the information, and tries to kind of push knowledge forward. A pseudoscientist pretends to do that, but really just like rips something from the headlines and starts selling it without any concept of the efficacy. So it's possible that Brinkley thought this could work.
See, that's a question I had throughout, actually.
Yeah.
What does he believe at this point and at other points? Because, I mean, did he know that was nonsense and that he was going to fool these poor saps who were desperate and vulnerable? Or did he actually think in some way, I mean, the placebo effect, you know?
Sure.
He was a believer, churchgoer, so maybe he thought faith may have some, you know, so it's unclear, really, at least. What do you think? Do you think he was just maliciously trying to fool people?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think even if he was trying to fool people, he would be confronted and was confronted with people standing in front of him saying, "Doc, you've cured me. Thank you so much." Crying, you know, happy. So it's. I think that a lot of those people can believe their own lies after a while. So I don't know. It's part of what made him interesting to me, the wrestling with this question, exactly that question. Like, what did he think he was doing? I'm sure he believed he was a great man in many ways. I mean, I don't know how someone like that sleeps at night if they don't.
It must have been really appealing and tempting to have been told time and time again, people coming in and saying, you know, because, look, they said, "We are pregnant. Something happened. Something." And dozens of people told him this.
Sure, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands.
Exactly.
It's hard to know. And I'm just going to inject this note here because this is a documentary film about a person who lied every day, all the time. So it's a fun challenge for me. So every piece of information that I have has to be questioned because the sources are mostly coming from him.
Yeah.
So even when it looks like I'm pulling a newspaper clipping or an educational science film or a biography, after I investigate it, I find out that his PR team wrote it, he made it, he controlled it. So this is a good example. People say, "How many people had this surgery?" Well, he says tens of thousands. I don't have really that great of a way of checking that fact.
Yeah.
So it could be hundreds. But I don't think so because he made a lot of money. So it had to have been enough for him to get quite wealthy during the Depression.
Yeah. radio comes into the story. I love this part. Let me play another moment. This is Pope Brock, and he's the one who wrote the book that you first found in that library.
Correct, yeah. It's a great book. I recommend it.
And he's great talking about
it,
too.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's funny, and he gets the joke, right? I mean, and he's talking about, as you'll hear, which is kind of interesting, like how the goat thing kind of worked and how this really sort of segues into radio coming into play. Here's another moment from Penny Lane's documentary film Nuts.
In the early 20s, just based on word of mouth, he had people starting to flock into Milford, Kansas, right, this little town. At first, they came bringing their own goats. Pretty soon, he had his own herd of goats out back. The patient would come, Brinkley would take them out back, they would browse the herd. Patient would select a goat with which he felt the most connection. Then they would come in and do this sort of double operation. But soon, and we're talking 1923, I think, very early on when radio was just beginning, Brinkley realized what radio could do. He saw the future.
I was really interested in this part where he gets on the radio and it's, you know, nice music. Everyone's hearing sort of nice music. And he starts talking about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and this was in the 1920s.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was Pope or somebody describes him as kind of the Ruth Westheimer of his time.
Correct. Yeah.
So what was it about? Because that must have been appealing for people that he sort of broke this taboo. He was talking about sex. He was talking about these sexual conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was part of the appeal in some
way? Absolutely. I mean, he may have been doing it just to, you know, make money, but nonetheless, you know, he was sort of independent media, right? So we've got the situation where there's this new medium, and very quickly these big corporations begin to dominate and dictate what radio will be. It will be safe for corporations and families, you know? Mm. And there's these maverick broadcasters out there, and Brinkley's one of them. He's a very important early broadcaster. He's one of the first people to popularize what they called hillbilly music, which now we call country music. You know, he was very innovative in the form. They did all kinds of interesting things, and they just tried all these different things, and people loved the station. It was the most popular radio station in America. And one of the things that made it popular was that you didn't ever know what was going to happen, and sometimes people got on there and started talking about impotence and problems in the bedroom. And here's this man with this seductive voice who's telling you, you know, your doctor's telling you that there's no cure, but there is a cure. And I have it. Come to Kansas. Come at once. And people just came to Kansas.
There is this when he runs afoul.
Which had to happen eventually.
It had to happen eventually. And he doesn't test any of these kinds of things. And this is the other element that I think is really interesting. And I want to play another moment. This is Pope Brock again. Because he figures out how to use the medium. And in effect, he kind of creates junk mail and infomercials.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
Let's play another moment. Here's Pope Brock again from the film Nuts.
By the late 20s, he was on the radio with something called Medical Question Box, right? Where people would write in, describe their symptoms, and then he would prescribe for them over the radio. Bags and bags and bags of mail are coming in every day. He's got a team of secretaries pawing through it every morning. It becomes so successful that then he works out this whole thing with druggists. He had a network of hundreds of druggists around the Midwest where they would stock Brinkley medicines. And he was so agile and he was so convincing. In an era when everybody thought radio was a novelty or at best, he saw that he could use it to rule commercially and turn himself into a king, which is exactly what he did.
Now, I think there's something here that's really important. You've talked about this before, that what he figured out was if you want to get people to part from their money, you tell them a good story.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's what was cool for me. So as a documentary filmmaker working in nonfiction storytelling, I started to feel like what I was doing was not so different from what he was doing.
Yeah.
I was sort of taking bits and pieces of the truth, and I was arranging them in a way that I knew would be seductive to people to make them want to watch my movie. And this was another thing that just kept me really excited about working on it. Again, when you're working on these films, I mean, it's an independent film. This is like not a movie that anyone asked me to make or paid me to make. So you really have to have something that keeps you interested. So I talked earlier about how kind of questioning the nature of belief and why we want to believe in stories like this was really part of it. And the other part of it was this kind of like ongoing preoccupation with the idea that what I was doing was really similar to what he was doing. And that really got me going. Like that made me feel really excited because I spend a lot of time in my life thinking about nonfiction as a form and questioning the ethics and the kind of epistemological issues that come with, you know, taking the disaster that is reality and then shaping it and packaging it into a cool story. So this was a movie where I was like, okay, I get to like do that with this fun story about goat testicles and this great guy and this like cool episode in American history, but also allow myself to really like engage those questions for myself as a filmmaker.
Penny Lane is with us. She's the director of Nuts. There's one more screening, so you sort of have a shot to see it. It's tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock in Park City. There's a wait list for that, but as we've said, you never know. So go to our website, radiowest.org, for links and more information. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's the pitch for filmmaker Penny Lane's documentary at Sundance this year. It's the story of this charismatic doctor named John Romulus Brinkley. In 1917, he said that he had cured impotence with goat testicle transplants. Penny Lane is with us to talk about this crazy story. There's a lot going on here, and at times it's hard to know who you're supposed to root for or who you're supposed to believe. There's one more screening. We'll tell you more about that. There's a wait list, but you can give it a shot. Okay, so at some point, the American Medical Association comes into this picture, and you hate the AMA right away. Like, you know, like the way John Brinkley tells of it, this is the establishment again. Mm-hmm. And he's the little guy. And then we get this terrific character who comes into the picture. And in some ways, at least in this first part of the film, he's the antagonist. Morris Fishbein is his name. He's the severe, arrogant, single-minded doctor. And his crusade is against quackery.
What he calls quackery,
right, exactly. Talk about him, because he's a great character. And I love how conflicted I feel about him throughout.
Yeah, he is a great character. And, you know, he really stands for the American Medical Association. And if you've spent any time thinking about the AMA, you should have conflicted feelings about it. On the one hand, they're kind of really trying to protect you from horrible charlatans and bad people that are just trying to hurt you and take your money. On the other hand, they are a guild, and they are by nature exclusionary and by nature conservative and slow to adopt, you know, sort of new treatments. And for better or worse, they represent kind of the standard bearers of Western medicine. So, you know, Brinkley knows that you have that conflicting feeling, and he's happy to exploit it to his benefit.
Right.
And Morris Fishbein is amazing. He's this interesting guy. He goes to medical school around the time that John Brinkley is not going to medical school, and really takes this straight and narrow path and really is obsessed, and that's a good thing, I think, with trying to stamp out quackery and protect people. And it's his whole life's mission is to sort of like try to, you know, educate the public about these guys that like John Brinkley.
But he's kind of like James Randi.
Yeah.
Like a skeptic. But we love James Randi and Morris Fishbein for some reason, at least the way Brinkley portrays him.
You know, you have to realize that we've created a story
here. That's what I'm saying.
There's
that's probably
a great film that I could make starring Morris Fishbein where he's the hero.
Totally. Yeah,
but
no,
I didn't make that film.
No,
in
no.
my film, he's the nemesis.
Because that's the way Brinkley portrays him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it changes, right, over the course of the film.
That's the point. I mean, I think that's what the interesting thing is. You're headed somewhere in this film. And then you change. And then he's like, oh, Morris Fishbein, he's this rational, skeptical guy. I'm like him. I'm more like him than I thought.
Yeah.
Instead of this sort of bald doofus that you think of, right? Because you see the pictures in the animation at first.
Yeah.
Let's talk about radio, too. This is because the FCC comes into the picture, at least the government agency that becomes the FCC. In those days, it was the Federal Radio Commission, FRC. And Fishbein appeals to this commission to put a stop to Brinkley's – because he's been giving these medical tips.
Prescribing over the radio.
Prescribing over the radio.
Which
exactly.
is not, you know – It was an innovative idea,
right?
Great idea, but like really not the way you should practice medicine.
Yeah. There's an actor here reading Fishbein's words. You'll also hear the radio historian Gene Fowler in this moment from the film Nuts.
The AMA is doing its part to destroy quackery and is depending upon the Federal Radio Commission to swiftly put an end to KFKB, where Brinkley spews forth his irregular filth into the ears of millions.
The Federal Radio Commission was created to rein in all these maverick broadcasters and to try to keep radio safe for corporations and families and to try to impose some order on the wild radio dial that flourished at the time. The beast that we know today as the FCC had its beginnings in the FRC back in the late 20s.
So there are these hearings. He's called to these hearings, and it's interesting, at least when the first time he's confronted, he's able to make his case. And one of the reasons he's able to, and this is interesting, is that he uses satisfied customers to make the case, and people, and one after another makes the case, and not only that, and this is some of the testimony that you reveal in the film, you know. And think about these things that would work today. The government is telling me what to do. You can't tell me what to do. I can go to Dr. Brinkley if I want to. The radio station is our community radio station. You can't tell us what we can play. Kansas folks know best. The committee's afraid of losing control. You can't stifle country music.
Yeah.
And it all works, at least
of course
then.
It works because, you know, and it would work now. I mean, it's exactly right. And again, in some ways, you know, I feel like in this conversation, I've been almost a little hard on Brinkley. The radio station really was very popular. It was a cool station, you know. And in the FRC was probably wrong to shut it down. It was the most – imagine this – the most popular radio station in America. The government says, yeah, you're wrong. We know what's best. We're going to take it away from you. It turned out to be a huge mistake, which we'll get to.
Absolutely.
but yeah, so in the medical stuff is more complex, I think, but they have a point. You know, why should the government decide what I can do with my doctor? We still have these problems today, right?
Yeah, and he's not one-dimensional, Brinkley, in any way. And there is a moment – you can talk about this. I mean, he gets his license revoked. He gets both of his licenses revoked, his medical license and his broadcasting license. But he doesn't stop.
Mm-mm.
He plugs forward and this was amazing. He runs for governor and he wins the election basically. But I mean, it was stolen from him.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, every sign points to that. Again, when you're doing historical research, you have to accept that there's a sort of limit to what you're going to know for sure happened, right?
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, after many, many years of research, yes, the write-in campaign for Brinkley was enormously successful. And then the attorney general said at the very last minute, only if you spell his name exactly correctly and write it in this way will the vote count, which is very suspicious and doesn't really go with what we think, what we know to be the sort of intent of a write-in campaign, the laws that would dictate that.
And think of literacy in those days.
Yeah, so like you literally like misspell his name and the vote gets thrown out. So 56,000 votes were thrown out and he was not governor of Kansas. So he was governor of Kansas, but he wasn't governor of Kansas. Perfect for Brinkley.
Perfect for Brinkley because as you talk about in the film, I think it's maybe Gene Fowler or somebody anyway, says that he essentially didn't demand a recount.
No.
Because he wasn't sure he really wanted to be governor. I mean, there wasn't much of a salary to being governor of Kansas.
So in my opinion, you know, he did not want to be governor of Kansas. He just was having a lot of fun doing this campaign, shaking everyone up, messing with the established political parties, just like using his money and his popularity to like kind of make trouble. And I think he loved that. He loved to be that guy. I mean, the idea of him actually having to sit in an office and run Kansas does not fit with what I know about that man's life.
Is Donald Trump coming to mind?
Well, I mean, you know, I can't say what's going on in Donald Trump's mind, but it sounds similar to me, you know, and now we're going to get hate mail. So thank you for that.
So what he does to, you know, he gets his broadcast license revoked. So he just moves his radio station to Mexico.
Yeah.
And he creates, I mean, if it was powerful then, because a lot of people were listening to it then, it's massive now. Talk about this part of the story when he goes to Mexico.
Oh, it's my favorite part. You know, so Brinkley said several, you know, he loved to say this thing over the course of his lifetime in many different places. He said, "The harder they hit me, the higher I bounce." And that is what happened with this radio station. They're like, okay, the FCC, the FRC says you can't have a radio station. He says, fine, I'm going to move 2 feet over the border into Mexico, and I'm going to build a radio station that is 1,000 times more powerful. Like, you will regret what you have done to me. And he does. And he does it. And then this radio station is so powerful that it reaches 17 countries. And, you know, interferes with all the other stations that are on the air that the FCC is saying is okay. So he just causes so much trouble with this station. It's a great part of the movie. It's like sort of like the real outlaw phase of his life. You know, like he makes a run for the border and stuff gets bigger and crazier.
Huge.
And more colorful than ever.
Birds drop out of the sky. This thing is so powerful. People
supposedly.
Of course. And people said they could pick up the radio station with their fillings or through barbed wire. Such a great story. Here's Gene Fowler talking again. He's talking – what I love about this part is these infomercials that he creates, the pioneer of the infomercial, and some of the – this is a really great little montage in the film. I want to play it here. Another moment from Nuts.
Lengthy commercials go on for 5 to 30 minutes, and they would be repeating things over and over and over and spelling out the names of the towns where you'd send your dollar to get your – astrology lessons.
The secrets of the stars.
Burial tombstones.
The elegantly deceased.
Bow ties that light up in the dark.
The height of fashion.
Guaranteed bed bug killer.
Stop bed pests.
Toenail adjusters.
Most toenails are not properly adjusted.
Hemorrhoid medicine.
For the inferior posterior.
Autographed photo of Jesus Christ.
Signed in your choice of ink or blood.
And color pack was real popular as a hair dye.
Colorback is a solution for artificially coloring hair
through
your gray hair, and it's guaranteed, yes, very.
Colorback actually had some kind of lead in it.
So somebody would have probably invented infomercials if Brinkley hadn't, but he must have had an influence on, in some way, don't you think, in infomercials and junk mail and the way that
Absolutely.
Is developing? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say he was a master, an early master of what we now call public relations. It wasn't exactly even a term yet when he started doing it, but he instinctually understood what he needed to do to reach people. So he would send out just thousands and thousands and thousands of beautifully designed color circulars that would just show up in your mailbox, you know, just really seductive, like cool stuff. And then these infomercials that went on for, as he said, like 30 minutes, an hour, all night long, just person after person saying over and over again, like, send a dollar, send a dollar, send a dollar. I mean, it's like really amazing stuff that, you know, again, you're right. Someone else would have invented it. And maybe someone else did around the same time. Yeah. You know, it's not like I'm claiming that he, you know,
started it.
Didn't start it all. You know, he can't like give him credit for everything. But he's a brilliant, brilliant master of advertising and PR. And he picks up on all of it very early and innovates a lot in the form, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, yeah. There's a really nice sort of sequence in the film, section in the film, where he's kind of living it up. And I really liked this moment. We're seeing him. He and his wife have a son. They go and travel on. He has this yacht and this beautiful sort of palatial home with a pool in Texas, Del Rio, Texas. He has these light shows that he puts on for the neighbors. And it's here where we get to see sort of home movies. Would you talk about this moment? I really liked this section, just a sense of kind of his life and his – he had this kind of strange, I don't know, kind of lovely affection for flowers.
He loves flowers. He's a deep romantic, Brinkley. You know, he – this is a part – it's probably about halfway into the film that you're talking about. And again, you know, we've seen him struggle and work and fight and fight and like really have to kind of constantly scrabble and whatever that word – scrabble? Is that a word?
It's a good enough word.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's a word.
Scramble.
Scramble. Yeah. To kind of like, you know, keep himself fighting and afloat. And so – we wanted to give him a moment to just sort of luxuriate in his success, you know. And he is very rich at this point. I'm also saying, hey, look how rich he is, which I've kind of been hiding from you for up until that point in the film because I want you to be on his side. And so much of that is his underdog status. But here's a moment where you're like, oh, this is a very large mansion, you know. And he seems to own several airplanes and many yachts. And you're like, oh, I see. So it's kind of just a lovely moment where you can sort of sit back and enjoy his success with him.
There's, I want to play the clip where he is talking to people about sitting amidst these flowers. What was that?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, as I said, I mean, he seems to be quite the romantic, and his attachment to flowers is very real, and it comes up a lot throughout all of his radio addresses.
I hope you people have enjoyed these lovely flowers from our gardens here in Del Rio, Texas. You know, I've told you that I have called our home here in Del Rio a little bit of heaven. The flowers you have seen were cut for breakfast this morning and put here in the room to be put in this picture for your enjoyment. And when you see flowers and hear the song of birds and see the sparkle of a dewdrop in the sunshine, think of the great power in the universe and the giver of all good gifts that makes these lovely things possible for we mortals here below.
He had a way with words.
Yeah, he did. He could sit on the radio and just sort of ad-lib for hours and hours and hours, and people said that it was just wonderful. We only have so many recordings of him now. You know, it's not as if there was a sort of stable recording technology, yeah. You know, sort of preservation. So I only have a few hours of him talking now, and it's quite something. It's strange by today's standards. You know, it's sort of slow.
A little contrived, but
yeah.
Pretty cool to hear.
Yeah, he's got a great voice, I think. Do you think so?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good radio voice?
No, a really good radio voice. Yeah. And the accent makes him seem homey. And,
yeah.
Well, things about this point in the story start to turn, and we'll talk about it with Penny Lane when we get back from a break. The film is called Nuts. There's one more screening tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock in Park City. There's a wait list for that, but you can go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the filmmaker Penny Lane. We're talking about her crazy film Nuts, which is part of the Sundance U.S. documentary competition this year. There's one more screening for the film tomorrow, and you can get details about that on our website. Okay, so I really like this story. I wanted to have you just talk a little bit about it. So his nemesis, Dr. Brinkley, is Morris Fishbein. And they actually... Well, they don't. I'm not sure if you could say they meet, but they have this wild confrontation. I don't know if it's even wild. It's just momentary. You want to tell that story?
Sure. So, you know, in 1937, Brinkley, as we were discussing before the break, is really on top of the world. I mean, he's wealthy beyond his wildest dreams. He's successful. His radio station is going great. Everyone loves it. Or, I mean, I don't know if everyone loves it, but it's taken over your radio station, whether you love it or not.
Right.
He's got a chain of hospitals now. I mean, he's got like just this huge empire. And he and his wife go on a 3-month cruise on a cruise ship that was very famous at the time called the Normandy. The Normandy was like the Titanic. I mean, it was like a huge, really top of the line luxury liner. So this was their 3-month cruise. They get on the boat, and who's there but Morris Fishbein on the same cruise. So the way the story is told really kind of varies. So the version that we went with in the film was the version that I decided I liked the most because I don't really know what happened on that boat. But basically they just sort of see one another from across this crowded ballroom and they stare at one another and then they both storm off. It's like the weirdest, not cinematic confrontation ever, but that was kind of fun for me to play with.
Does he actually wink at him, by the way?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what happens, man. Right. Like, I'm doing reenactments here. I get to, like, have some, you know, imagination was used in the
Absolutely.
Course of this film. You know, it's 79-minute runtime and 53 minutes of it is animated reenactment. So, you know, I mean, I'm working from transcripts and newspaper clippings and books and all these things, but, you know, I did have to imagine some things.
How long did it take to get the animation done?
2 years.
Really?
So,
wow.
Yeah. It was crazy. But yeah, so that confrontation is quite important. I think Fishbein seeing Brinkley on this boat.
Living it up.
Infuriated him.
Yep.
You know, that guy should not be here. That guy should not be on this boat. And he even writes, he rushes home and he writes this long two-part article called Modern Medical Charlatans. And it's really all about Brinkley and what a bad guy he is and sort of, again, sort of making his case to the people. Like, people, stop giving this guy your money. Like, hey, government, do something to get rid of this guy. Shut him down. And in that article, he says weird things like he, you know, neither he nor Mrs. Brinkley engage in conversation with the other passengers. And you're like, why is that a thing? Like, why do you care about that?
It's so small-minded, some of it.
Yeah, it's quite petty in some strange way.
Yeah.
But yeah, so again, it's that complexity of that character that's so fun for me. He is right, but then his way of expressing it is quite often very grating.
Well, it's the thing that really gets to Brinkley. I think he probably, like, he's used to being called a charlatan, I guess, but
the snobbery.
The snobbery, yeah.
Just really bugs him.
And he sues him.
Yes.
For libel.
Yes.
Brinkley sues Fishbein for libel.
Yes, because this article is quite long and detailed and essentially says this guy's a quack and a charlatan. And Brinkley says, no, I'm not. That's libel. I'm suing you.
And this turns out, of course, to be a fateful decision that Brinkley makes. And this is like one of the flaws. This is the thing that really goes wrong for him. Okay, let's hear from Pope Brock again, because he talks about day one of the trial, which is great, because you get a sense of how things, you know, could possibly go. And again, he has this huge, as Pope Brock says, he has this huge cheering section with him. This is March 22nd, 1939.
The trial took place in the county courthouse in Del Rio, and it was packed. It was packed out the door. A lot of women. He had a sort of weird sex appeal that was inexplicable except to a certain stratum of middle-aged women. But there were a lot of them. So he had his whole cheering section there. He also had a big team of lawyers. He had at least five lawyers. Fishbein didn't have anything like that kind of legal firepower or money. He's still just the editor of a fairly obscure magazine. What Brinkley also had in that courtroom was a series of satisfied customers, which were the foundation of his legal strategy.
But that was pretty much all he had for his legal strategy.
Yeah.
And the judge ruled you can't use any of them. They're not experts. They're just expressing this opinion. And I don't want to give too much away. We can say it does not go well for Dr. Brinkley.
Yeah, this is the tragic final act of his life. And in the over the course of the trial, all the things we've been talking about up until now are reconsidered. And
this is a great part of the film. You did such a great job here, by the way.
Thank you. As a viewer, you know, you've hopefully been kind of just enjoying yourself and been swept up in this story. And it's a very entertaining story. And this is really the point in the film where we go back to the beginning and sort of reexamine each of the kind of key claims that have been made by Brinkley throughout this film and see them in a very different light.
And it's where you used to kind of start to feel bad for him almost in some way, but also that, oh, he's getting his comeuppance. And that's the part of the conflict, I guess. I mean, I guess if you, I don't know. What did you think? I guess we saw it coming, right? I mean, you know this guy's a liar.
Mm-hmm.
But you've helped us kind of like him.
Absolutely. I've aligned you with him. He's the hero of the story. That's what you do when you make a story.
Yeah.
And it's not hard to do. And that was kind of part of the message in a way of the film. Like, I don't make message films, but there's a way that I hope that having that experience of being kind of made to be aligned, made to root for somebody by a filmmaker. That's me. You know, documentaries are made by somebody. They are directed. People kind of continually forget that, and including me. And I think anything that I can do as a documentarian to kind of remind people that when you see an 80-minute film that appears to be a kind of tight story, some shaping has happened, right? Like some manipulation has occurred. And in this film, you are reminded of that very, I hope, strongly in that third act.
The Fishbein, when he's on the stand, he essentially breaks down what is a quack. In a very clear, there are three parts to a quack, and he explains how it is that he thinks Brinkley lives up to that. You know, he wraps himself, a quack wraps himself in a grand story. He doesn't share his treatments with others. He keeps it to himself. He's a, you know, master manipulator. And there were a couple of elements that I thought were so interesting. What was interesting about the story also is that the way Brinkley tells it at first, the people who were after him in those early days had these horrible fates come to them. And none of that was true either. But I think that's a trope. Like, it seems like that's a recurring theme in these stories.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a little bit of a weird threat. Like, basically he says, you know, come after me and bad things will happen to you. And then he tells the whole world in his, you know, sort of commissioned biography that, you know, all the doctors that went against him early on all die an early death and all these terrible things happen to them. And then, of course, we find out in the trial that none of that happened. But the other thing about a quack that they do is they have a miracle cure.
Yep.
That's the most important thing to be on the lookout for. When someone says, I have a cure that they don't want you to know about, right? And they're appealing to this kind of like sense of a conspiracy theory, really. Like, you know, the government doesn't want you to know, fill in the blank. That's the most important red flag for all the quacks. Like, that's the one that you want to keep an eye out for.
Yeah. You ask Pope Brock if you thought Dr. Brinkley was worth remembering. He says, of course. You feel that way? Of course, obviously.
Yeah. I spent 8 years trying to resurrect him from the, you know, the past. So yeah, I guess I do.
We're out of time, but let me ask you this. Did you still like him?
Yeah.
You still like him?
Absolutely. I like him. I think he's a genius. He made the world more colorful. He made the world more interesting. Yes, he was a bad guy. He was probably out for nothing but personal gain, as Pope Brock says. But, you know, he kind of like enveloped the world in magic. I can't help it. He's a good guy. He's interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting person.
Penny Lane, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Director of Nuts, there's one more screening tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock in Park City. Go to our website for the particulars. We should thank the people at community radio station KPCW for hosting us during the festival. Larry Warren, Bob Hendricks, Ethel Preston, and Scott Matthews. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.